U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Donald Trump defends the U.S.-Saudi relationship after the Saudi government murder, intelligence service murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Can Trump sustain his policy despite bipartisan opposition in Congress? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot, here with my colleagues Bill McGurn. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Paul.
And Dan Henninger.
Good with you.
Here in a pre-Thanksgiving podcast. And biggest foreign policy news of the week certainly would seem to be, Dan, that statement dictated by the president himself, according to his advisors, complete with 8 or 9 exclamation points and such classic Trumpisms as did Mohammed bin Salman murder Jamal Khashoggi or did he know about it? We will never know. Maybe he did and maybe he did not. Maybe he did.
Exclamation point.
Exclamation point. But in any case, Trump is not going to change American policy. He's a stalwart on behalf of the U.S.-Saudi relationship. And it didn't appear he's going to countenance any change in the relationship other than the 7th sanctioning with Magnitsky Act sanctions, the 17 individuals who the Saudis have themselves identified as in being involved.
Well, yeah, I guess what you could describe the president's statement on Saudi Arabia and the Khashoggi murder is as realpolitik on steroids. Realpolitik, of course, is the famous foreign policy theory that one conducts foreign policy in terms of a country's own interest and as in, you know, in terms of pragmatism and without much concern about other issues such as human rights. And that has evolved over time as a kind of an idea that developed in the 1950s. But as the United States moved deeper into the world through the Cold War and afterwards, presidents such as Ronald Reagan understood that the United States also had a unique role in the world. It wasn't like any other country, that it did indeed stand for certain norms, ideals, values represented by the idea of the United States itself. And most presidents acknowledge that. President Trump did not in this statement. He said our interests are simply our own. He described their interest in the Middle East as combating Iran. And so there was no real acknowledgement in any way that the murder of Jamal Khashoggi by his own country was an abhorrent offense against the things we stand for. Now, I think, to my mind, Paul, the big question to raise here is whether the president is succeeding on his own terms. He's laid out policy, foreign policy initiatives, or at least interest in the Middle East, but it is not clear that he's articulated a strategy or a goal. And secondarily, if he is going to pursue a strategy in the Middle East, which we understand is to combat Iran, where are his allies going to come from? Because he seemed to have driven a wedge with this statement between himself and many of his natural allies on Capitol Hill, such as Senator Lindsey Graham or incoming Senator Mitt Romney. So I think, to my mind, Paul, that's kind of the issue here, is whether the president is succeeding with this kind of hard-nosed realpolitik, or whether he's done some damage to his own foreign policy interests.
Yeah, I agree with that. Look, I'm a person, I wouldn't dismiss interests, and I wouldn't dismiss economic interests. We have interests. Interests are not a dirty word. We're in Saudi Arabia for a reason. I wouldn't have expressed it quite as crassly as the president did. But I also think the reality of America is not only are we a nation that stands for certain values, people expect a somewhat moral response from America. I think that was Reagan's appeal against the realpolitik of Nixon and Kissinger. And I'll give you an example. We're all old enough to remember Tiananmen Square and the aftermath. And so here's the world's largest country, They've just butchered a bunch of people demonstrating for their rights. What do you do? Well, the Bush administration sent over people, and they were photographed clinking champagne glasses, right? And I think the toast was something, we're going to unite against our common enemies. It was a disaster. I'm not sure Reagan would have had a different policy, but I think he would have had a group of Chinese students at the Rose Garden or something to show where our sympathies are. And that would give you more. The point is, if you do that, you make clear what your moral position is. You have more leeway to make the practical accommodations you have. That said, I think the crown prince is in a tough position. I think he's lost
Mohammed bin Salman,
whom we suspect of knowing about this, if not ordering it himself. And, the luster's gone off. I don't think he could ever repair it. I think the Trump administration would be wise not to have him to the United States. I don't think he can ever recover it. But I do think that what we need is, again, after Tiananmen Square, Richard Nixon went over to China, friend of China, and said to these guys, you really screwed up. There's a famous letter to Deng Xiaoping. And we need something like that to Saudi Arabia, just to stop the kind of cockamamie excuses they're giving, and maybe offer them some examples of things they could do to restore some credibility. I'm not sure the crown prince's credibility can ever be restored.
Well, it looks like the King Salman, who installed MBS, as he's known, Mohammed bin Salman, as the actual leader of Saudi Arabia, is going to be replaced. Salman's not going to replace him. That's the way it seems. And with this endorsement by the U.S. president, that would certainly be the removal of one incentive to remove or diminish MBS's authority. But I think the question that I would raise regarding your point, Dan, about the effectiveness of this is you suggested it's a matter it's a problem for domestic politics, and I agree with you. I think it could be, but I also think it's a problem for just how reliable an ally is MBS. If in fact he is having dissident journalists killed in a way that makes life exceptionally difficult for the U.S. Saudi alliance, and when you add that to the willful, reckless way he's prosecuted the war in Yemen without end now for several years, and to the detriment of Saudi's reputation in terms of the killing of civilians, the blockade against Qatar, for example. Now, Qatar's not a saintly actor here, but he's been isolating himself in many ways, MBS, and I think that you have to raise some questions about this young man's judgment. He's only 33 or so. Can we trust him? And you have to wonder, does this kind of public declaration of support and indeed a kind of reductionist view of American interests, oil, arms sales, Iran, the three, and that's it. Sorry, I'm going home golfing for the weekend. That kind of reductionist statement gives him a little too carte blanche, MBS, too much the sense that, well, I can do anything now.
Well, this scandal is several months old, and it kind of came out of nowhere. It's the last thing people would expect. The murder of Jamal Khashoggi was ridiculous. I mean, an individual goes into a consulate in Istanbul and gets killed. This was a prominent figure, a well-known journalist. But the result suggests that the administration was caught off guard. They didn't really have a plan B, do not have a plan B after MBS. And it also suggests that the talent pool at the top of Saudi Arabia and its government is very, very thin. You don't hear anyone discussed beyond Mohammed bin Salman. There's some other figures whose names have come up. I think that, believe it or not, the minister of tourism, who's apparently another son of King Salman, has been named as a possible successor. But beyond that, not much of anyone. So, the president and the Secretary of State Pompeo and John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, they're kind of stuck at the moment. But I agree with you that they're going to have to think hard about whether indeed America's interests lie going into the future, because The Saudis and MBS have been a primary ally, and if he is going to prove himself unreliable in the future, we are going to need a backup foreign policy over there.
We're talking about the U.S.-Saudi relationship in the wake of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and you're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Dan Henninger and Bill McGurn, and we're talking about the U.S.-Saudi relationship. And the question I would ask, Bill, another question I would ask is, what did Donald Trump get from MBS for this rather remarkable and often even crass declaration of American support for Saudi based on raw economic and strategic interests without any real criticism on the human rights side of things? Do we get anything out of it from MBS, or is this a bet on the come?
Yeah, no, I don't think we do get on it. But I think, again, the hard reality is there's no good answer, even if you put out a perfect good statement, right? I mean, that's the problem, that the likely alternatives to the regime in Saudi Arabia are worse.
Let me push back on you in that sense. When I say get something from it, what about, okay, you put us in a bad spot, MBS. Here's what we'd like you to do. You're going to have to let these women drive.
Right.
And you're not going to have to let them out of jail. You're going to have to open up some of the more tolerance towards Christian religious practice. You're going to have to prosecute the war in Yemen differently. We're no longer going to help you not only with refueling but also targeting.
Right.
And we'll help you maybe interdict arms from Iran. But just lay out a group of things like that. You're going to have to settle this fight with Qatar.
I absolutely agree, although the question is, do you get those things by publicly calling on him to do it or pushing him to do it? And let me finish. This was the point I've been making about Nixon. After Tiananmen Square, Nixon went to Deng Xiaoping. He was greeted because he was a friend of China. And he gave a list in his letter of things that they should do. I think that's what I absolutely believe that's what the administration should do. I'm not sure even that would fix it. But we've been in this position before. Marcos killed Mr. Aquino when he came back to the country. We didn't abandon the Philippines. The South Korean military regime tried to kill Kim Dae-jung, was stopped by the CIA. We didn't abandon South Korea because there are tough considerations in the region. This is a tough one. I don't see how the Crown Prince ever recovers. And the fundamental problem is they're not a free country, so they can't sort of take care of it on their own, right? I mean, maybe people in the regime conspire against him, but he's arrested so many of them. Who's going to dare to do that? So this is the problem when your ally is not a democratically elected leader.
I covered the Philippines and South Korea during that era, Bill, and you're correct absolutely that the regime did not – that the Reagan administration did not abandon those allies. It did, however, put a lot of pressure on them.
If you remember, Reagan got an awful lot of criticism after the election for backing Marcos, and very similar to today. It's a tough look. The idea that there are simple solutions to this. Look, most of the regimes in the Middle East have huge problems. Egypt, you know, we sort of back al-Sisi, and this is not a human rights paragon. Iran killed an FBI agent of ours over there on CIA business, right? Probably. He disappeared and so forth. They arrest our other people. There's not a lot of nice actors except for the Israelis, and I don't think it's a coincidence that the Israelis are democratically elected, because in that kind of country, a lot of the people would say, we got to change this for the reasons you outlined. But this, we're kind of relying on either the Crown Prince stepping down himself or forces within the very large royal family taking things into their own hands. Not a good way forward.
Well, you know, Bill, you mentioned simple solutions. There are indeed there is a school of thought out there that there are simple solutions, which is to sever ties with Saudi Arabia. And there are many people in the media, and indeed some in Congress, suggesting exactly that, that this act is so abhorrent that we simply have to pull back. That simply gainsays the reality of why we've had a relationship with the Saudis since at least the end of World War II. Look at a map. This is a huge country. It is right in the middle of the Middle East. Egypt on one side, Iraq and Iran on the other side, the Persian Gulf, Straits of Hormuz. North of that, there is Turkey and Israel. It is a strategically important country. We simply cannot walk away. If we do, the Russians and the Chinese are ready, as the president suggested, to move in and displace us.
Well, let's step back a bit here. Remember Nixon and Kissinger, the ultimate practitioners of realpolitik, right? Outreach to China despite the Cultural Revolution and 30 million deaths and depredations. Arms control with Russia. The reaction against that, that was a kind of the purest expression in recent administrations of pure national interest foreign policy. One of the reactions to that was Jimmy Carter with his human rights salient and the focus on human rights. I thought that the Reagan administration in my lifetime had the best blend of what I would call realism and idealism in that Reagan talked about values. He wasn't afraid to label a country a bad actor. On the other hand, he did do business with them. And it's that blend of realism and idealism I think works best in the American system because you can't be a cold-blooded practitioner of realpolitik. At least that's what Kissinger has said from his own experience, based on his experience of American foreign policy, and make it sustainable.
In America, I agree thoroughly. I think this is one of the things that defines us. I think you could have that policy and explain it this way if you were French, right?
I absolutely agree.
I don't mean that as an insult. I just think a lot of Europeans would say that's being realistic. In America, there's a demand for a moral component. And look, and remember, a lot of the people went after Reagan because he called the Soviets the evil empire, but he didn't stop them from negotiating. So it's a tough thing. But America demands that the policy be moral at the root of it. And I think this isn't the end because Congress is going to get involved one way or the other.
Up to a point. We had an example at the other end of the spectrum with Barack Obama, an entirely moralistic foreign policy that got us into a lot of trouble around the world because it lacked realism.
Right.
Well, I think that's a fair point. But so where does this come out domestically as a matter of politics? You have, as you mentioned, some Republican critics here. Rand Paul is even going further, saying let's cut off Saudi Arabia totally. The Chuck Schumer and others are going to exploit this, notwithstanding their support for Barack Obama's policy, to try to undermine Trump's foreign policy and his standing. Is there going to be some kind of action in Congress that would force Trump to veto or maybe crimp ties with Saudi Arabia? For example, an attempt to impose Magnitsky Act sanctions on MBS or a cutoff of arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I think it could. I mean, and consider that going into next year, what is going to be at the top of the president's one of the things at the top of his foreign policy agenda is the follow-on trade deal with Mexico and Canada, which Congress has to approve. And you can bet that some of these senators and members of the House are going to be thinking of attaching provisions relating to Saudi Arabia in return for their support on NAFTA too. So the president, I think, has gotten himself into kind of a difficult situation here.
He could help himself, Bill, if when he issues these statements, he actually included a grace note about American ideals.
I agree. And I think at some point there will be some component forced on him. In the extreme form, it may take vetoing legislation. In the form, I hope, is that the administration would announce some steps that are seen as punitive without throwing away the relationship. I mean, at the very least, I think the Crown Prince can't come here and we can't have high-profile visits to Saudi Arabia as though it's just business as usual. So there'll be a lot of avenues. And look, This is one of the divides between the legislative and executive branch. It's very easy for congressmen to say cut ties and do this. Any administration, including the Obama, they have to deal with the reality and the outcome, and it's a tougher thing to do.
So, Dan, I remember a couple of years back we met with MBS here in New York City. I think he only kept us waiting for 90 minutes or so. I heard a friend of mine told me on the weekend he kept George W. Bush and after he had left office and James A. Baker, the former Secretary of State, for 2 hours.
Okay.
For 2 hours.
Oh, my God. To win friends and influence people.
But the thing about MBS at the time, I thought he was very impressive. In fact, I thought he was the most impressive Arab leader I had ever met. Now, he was probably the only Arab leader I ever met under 80. But he was energetic, he was forceful, and he had a clear set of goals that he said, I'm out to modernize my regime. I'm out to do culturally, economically, and militarily, we're going to stand up to Iran and so on. And I thought that there was a directness there that was refreshing from an Arab leader, and yet we see in his actions a kind of willfulness that makes you think, you know what, he needs a couple of domestic checks and balances to his ambitions.
Yeah, or at least outside checks and balances. I mean, I do remember that meeting, and he was impressive. He understood that the Saudi population, he had this enormous number of young people under the age of 25 who were dissatisfied with the corruption. That perhaps was the point of making all those arrests, several thousand people, sticking him in the Ritz-Carlton. Apparently that was popular with younger Saudis. And he indeed made it clear that he wanted Saudi Arabia to lean not just towards the West but to the United States, suggesting that he wanted his reforms in some sense to reflect the norms of the United States. Basically, the shock in this is that how much he has gone in the opposite direction since making this pitch. And it wasn't just us. Remember, they had to cancel that big financial meeting that they were going to have a couple weeks after the Khashoggi murder. And bankers, businessmen from all over the United States were signed up to attend that. And that was the result of Mohammed bin Salman making a sale to them in his visit to the United States. So that's what makes this just so disconcerting to so many people. He has really set his own country and his goals back a long way.
We will see how this unfolds. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back after Thanksgiving with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.